The time is 10:15. For the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Hawker, Representative Kutula, Vice Chair Stoltz, Co-Chair Meyer, and myself, Co-Chair Chenault. Also with us, we have Representative Coghill, Representative Guerra. I can't see anybody else behind the screen other than Representative Ledoux sitting over there in the second row. Good morning. This morning's schedule, we are planning to take up HB 301 or 3001.
Yes.
And we're also going to take up HB 3004. We'll start with Robin Wilson, who is the tax director, for the Department of Revenue. She'll introduce HB 301, walk us through it, and then we'll move on to HB 3004. That was 3001 for the record. Also with us, we have Representative Guttenberg. It's my intent to try to get through this. We'll see where we end up. Maybe 12:30, 1 o'clock if we're not completed. Depending on where we're at, we either may stay or we may try to break for lunch. I think I'd prefer to go through so that we don't lose all our members to other things going on. Also, Representative Jewell has joined us, and as we proceed, other representatives are present. I'll try to mention her name. Representative Foster is also with us. With us today, we also have Commissioner of Revenue, Bill Corbis. And Bill, I didn't get the opportunity to introduce you yesterday, but thank you for sitting in on the committee hearings. Does anything come for the committee, Representative Meyer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we get started, I just want to thank Representative Ramers and Representative Guerra for the donuts and bagels this morning. And perhaps that will be enough to hold us over so we can continue through lunch.
Okay.
Gatto tomorrow.
Gatto's tomorrow.
Representative Gatto is supplying donuts tomorrow.
And maybe we can get some more today.
Maybe get some more donations later today. With that, there's nothing else come for the committee. Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this committee have established a precedent that I believe it's important to follow regardless of some of the articles that have appeared in the paper. We're about to take up oil and gas taxes again. I would like to declare that I do have a potential conflict of interest in that a member of my immediate family is employed in the oil and gas industry in this state. And to that end, I would request the committee's unanimous consent that I be excused from these proceedings and not be required to participate or vote.
I'll object.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to request a record vote of the committee of every member, and I would like to place a call on the committee for the vote.
Mr. Chairman, is your intent to vote on these bills today, though?
The intent is not to vote on any of the bills today. The plan is to listen to HB 3001, HB 3004, and tomorrow take up HB 3003 to allow the committee to evaluate the three proposals that are in front of us before we decide which direction we're going to go.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I haven't had a chance to talk to Representative Hawker about this, but obviously I do have a potential conflict of interest that I'd like to declare again. But if the intent is not to vote or move these bills out of committee, I'd like to reserve that motion until the day that you do plan on taking a vote.
It is not the intent to vote on any of these issues today. So if I could get Representative Hawker to remove his
Chairman, I will withdraw my request. I will acknowledge that I will not participate in these hearings. I will sit here and not participate until such time as we've taken a unanimous vote of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Anything else come before the committee?
I just don't think it's fair enough to participate. He's a member of this committee, and he has every right to ask questions and get some more information on this very complex subject. I would object to him not participating. We're all equal members here of this committee, and I would look forward to any of the concerns he might have.
Okay. Representative Holm?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also agree with the representative from Nome. I find this to be a moot point, in my opinion, because we all come with a history. We have a representative that retired from the oil company sitting right down the from oil industry right down the street from me here, and there's a number of us that have a lot of history within the oil industry, and it has no bearing whatsoever on today's actions, and probably no bearing whatsoever on the outcome of this, whether or not we pass this out of the committee or not pass it out of the committee. There are 60 members of this legislature that will be voting on this, and not any one person or one of us can control the legislature. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other comments? Hearing none, we will move on. Representative Hawker, your concerns are noted. I have some of the same concerns. I think that, as Representative Myers stated, that we have the ability, without declaring a conflict in the Finance Committee, to be able to participate in the discussion. So I hope that you do. You bring a knowledgeable portion of this Finance Committee to the oil and gas issues. You're very heavily involved with them, and as you should be, and I hope that you do participate. But I think that, as Representative Myers stated, we're not voting on any issue. So until that point in time, I will entertain your motion to declare your conflict and have the committee vote on it at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's an admirable solution, and I sincerely appreciate the comments of Representatives Foster and Representative Holm.
Okay. With that, let's move on to HB 3001 and Robin, for the record. Before we start, I see that Representative Crawford has joined us, and I thought I seen Representative Samuel behind the curtain. So with that, go ahead, Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the Tax Director for the Department of Revenue. And what I'd like to do today is introduce HB 3001, the Governor's Bill for the PPT. And you have before you, I believe, a comparison matrix similar to that we've seen in the previous versions. The matrix is designed to highlight differences between the latest versions of the bill that we've seen. And so the number for you has four columns. The first column addresses the last version of the bill that was passed by the Senate, that is version F. The second column describes the latest version passed by the House, that is version XA. The third column addresses the Conference Committee substitute, that is version CA. And the fourth column highlights the Governor's Bill, that is version A, that is 2001. And this is a limited matrix, again, just highlighting sort of the differences between the versions. So at the pleasure of the committee, what I'd like to do is go through this matrix describing the differences, and then probably respond to questions rather than go through the bill, because I think the bill, you've seen it a number of times, the specific provisions, so I will focus instead on the differences. So starting off, what I'd like initially is to identify is that the bill is consistent with the Conference Committee substitute in a number of areas. So the language has been maintained in areas where there was, you know, agreement among the legislators. And one of those areas was the fact that instead of basically a statewide tax rate, a statewide system in full, there are essentially four areas established within the state that have slightly different treatment. In general, you're looking at the North Slope as the main area. Cook Inlet has special treatment, and there's special treatment for both Cook Inlet Gas and Cook Inlet Oil, so I would refer to those as two areas, if you will. And the fourth area then would be the area that is not North Slope and not Cook Inlet, and sort of that would be the other south area. And as I go through the rest of the matrix, you'll see special provisions that apply to each of those areas. So at the top of the matrix then, I've identified the tax rate, and the governor supports the tax rate of 20% as a fair and balanced tax rate, which is a statewide rate, but again, we'll see some peculiarities on specific regions. Specific to Cook Inlet oil, once the basic tax is figured out for the Cook Inlet oil, then there is a ceiling, and that ceiling, that tax ceiling for Cook Inlet oil is based on the ELF rate for Cook Inlet oil. Similarly for Cook Inlet gas, and those are separated here because there's a different ELF rate, that is economic limit factor, for Cook Inlet oils and Cook Inlet gas. So those are shown on the matrix separately. In the governor's bill, there is no progressivity surcharge. We continue to believe that that's not necessary for the balanced approach to the tax system. We acknowledge that the legislators have shown a great deal of interest in that, but we believe that it's not necessary. And so I would just highlight that difference among the columns. So in the conference committee, there was a progressivity surcharge based on net with a trigger of $35 a barrel. So the fourth column there shows none. The annual loss, credits for annual loss, if you'll recall, the way the bill works is if the at the end of the calculation of net taxable value, if there is a loss that results in a particular year, that loss can be carried forward, but it's, mechanically, it is then converted to a credit to be used in the next year. And so it's intended to be carried forward, the credit, with a tie to the tax rate. That is, whatever loss is incurred in 1 year, it's converted at the rate of tax into a tax credit to achieve parity. And so that's why on the line that says credits for annual loss, under the governor's bill, you'll see that that loss is converted to a credit at a rate of 20%, same as the tax rate. And so we can compare that then to the conference committee where the loss was converted at 22.8, again, which was consistent with the tax rate that was in that bill. In the conference committee substitute, there was a 3% floor. And the way the floor worked was that the CapEx credits could not be used to reduce the tax below 3% of growth for the North Slope region. That floor has been reduced or been eliminated in the governor's version. We do not believe that the floor is necessary. Moving on then, the next line says gas GRE, and that has not been present in the last couple of versions of the bill, but just for consistencies of presentation here, it was present in the latest version that was passed by the Senate. That's why the line is still there. But as you can see, the GRE has not been a feature of the bill in either the governor's bill nor the conference committee substitute. The next line is the transition TIE credit. That's a transitional investment credit. And that's the five-year CapEx look back. And the governor's bill maintains the language that was in the conference committee, which provided, we've used a shorthand of 2-for-1, which means that the current deduction for, or I'm sorry, the current credit for the transitional expenditures depends on current investment. The reason it says corrected is that the original language, which was developed in the Senate, there was just a mechanical problem when the what was originally a deduction was converted to a credit. There was just a problem in the numbers at the conversion rate. So that's why it says corrected. But we, again, the bill maintains the language from the last two versions on that provision. the base allowance credit. This is the $12 million credit based on production. Again, that's the governor's bill is consistent with the last couple of bills that you've seen, including the conference committee, and it's included again on here just for consistency. And the reason, if you look on that line, you'll see the $12 million credit equates to a $60 million deduction. I would just remind people that originally this provision was a deduction rather than a credit. In the original governor's bill, there was a $73 million deduction. The legislation, as it progressed during various versions, turned it into a credit. And so to sort of give people a comparison basis, I have consistently compared this to the deduction. And when you take $60 million credit based on a 20% tax rate, you equate to $60 million deduction. That is why, if you look in the third column, the $12 million credit equates to 52.6. It's a difference in tax rate. So there's no difference here in the language. It's just sort of I'm trying to get apples and apples here for everybody. The next item is the new area development credit, and a few minutes ago I talked about the fourth area of the state, that is the south part of the state that's not Cook Inlet, and this credit is a $6 million credit that's available $500,000 per month for areas that are not North Slope and not Cook Inlet. And that, again, is consistent with the conference committee substitute. That credit does have a 10-year sunset, and it's a rolling sunset for those producers that are just coming online to make it consistent among the producers. And that language, again, is consistent among the last several versions of the bill that you have seen. The oil spill language is the same as the conference committee. And the transition payment is the same as the conference committee substitute as well. And one last item, in the conference committee substitute, there was an amendment that when it was actually drafted into the language was not precisely, there was basically a typographical error. It was put in on the wrong line. So that has been fixed on that. So that basically summarizes the changes and highlights the differences among the versions. I would be happy to address any questions the committee might have.
Any questions? I think we've all heard this in some form or fashion over the last 6 months. Robin, back on the TIE credit, you know, I see there's a page difference, and I don't have the conference committee version that came out. Did you explain, and maybe I just didn't hear, what the difference is in the corrected version between the governor's bill and the conference committee bill?
There is no difference between the governor's bill and the conference committee. I was just highlighting why it said corrected, and it's actually been corrected for the last three versions. In the original Senate one, there was a problem just with the numbers.
Well, I noticed the page change, so that was that from the conference committee to the governor's new version.
I think that the page number difference results because there's no progressivity language in the governor's bill, so just the bill language moved up in position.
Any other questions? Joining us also, we have Representative Kelly, Representative Olson. And that's all I see. Robin, do you want to walk us through the fiscal note?
Yeah.
Just a moment, yes.
Also with us online, we have Representative Croft, and we also have Robert Vance for any legal questions.
Yes, I think you'll find the fiscal note fairly similar to what you have seen previously. I would just add a couple of things. The contractual expenditures include expenditures for programming. There would be significant reprogramming of tax division systems. There would be money in there for regulation writing, contractual regulation writing. Consultants and the small chargeback that happens. There are 10 positions in here, which is 8 auditors and 2 tax technicians. We've got additional returns that we would be processing under this bill. And in comparison to the governor's bill as it was originally put forth in February, you will see an increase in the auditor positions. As the bill has gone through a number of revisions, we have seen a number of complexities added, such as the 4 areas of the state and so on, which would require additional audit resources.
Okay. So the increase of the fiscal note is, do you know how much compared to the previous fiscal notes?
Let's see.
I won't put you on the spot. I can look it up.
I can. I don't know that I have the okay. change well, here, but I can certainly report.
Don't worry
that.
About it. We can look that up to see. Any other questions? I guess we're going to be pretty easy on you. Just to highlight, we're back to the original 2020 plan proposed by the governor, excluding Cook Inlet provisions, excluding or also including Cook Inlet provisions, no credit usage on the floor, no progressivity surcharge, and those are the 3 main changes between the conference committee and the governor's latest version. Correct. Other than maybe some minor technical changes in language, but other than that, I think the bill is the same bill we saw before the committee, before we went to the floor with it. So with that, Robin, if there's no other questions, thank you for introducing it, and we'll set House Bill 3001 aside, and next we will take up House Bill 3003. Representative Guerra.
3004.
Excuse me, 3004.
Chairman Chanel.
I was trying to get Representative Croft's attention. Representative Croft.
How you guys doing there, Chairman Chanel?
I didn't hear you, Eric.
Can you guys hear me now?
We can hear you now.
All right, thank you. I'm here in the beautiful Wrangell LIO, and we're headed your way, heading north. My pleasure to introduce House Bill 3003. You should have both the bill and a draft.
Representative Croft?
Yeah.
We're not going to hear your bill till tomorrow. I thought that I'd talk to people about we won't hear it. I just made a slip of the tongue when I said 3003 instead of 3004. We're going to wait until we have you in front of the committee to hear your bill tomorrow, if that is okay with you.
Well, we'll do whatever the chairman's pleasure is. I had made sure that I was available for it and had people available for it.
Yeah. Well, I planned on hearing your bill tomorrow.
It can be on camera.
So we'll take yours up tomorrow, and when you're back in town, we'll start on your bill at 10 o'clock in the morning.
I can hear the ear deflating.
So with that, Representative Garrett, we will start with HB 3004.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Let me just start out with something that came up yesterday. A few of you asked for some Wood Mackenzie materials, so I passed those out today. That was the Wood Mackenzie report that the legislature issued. They made two pages public, and it showed how Alaska ranked in terms of company profitability, very high at starting at about $30 a barrel, but on the lower end at below $20 a barrel. Company internal rates of return, again, higher than most places in the world. That's the Wood Mackenzie chart. You can certainly talk about it if folks want. My statement was that Alaska overall had overall costs lower than most places in the world. That's including taxes. I think you look at the full cycle government take page. It says the world average government takes about 73%. We've heard here it's about 67 to 70%. So according to Wood Mackenzie, that leaves about a 27% company net worldwide. In Alaska, at $35 a barrel, the company net is about 42%, according to the Wood Mackenzie report. And as prices go higher above $35 a barrel, our understanding is that the numbers get even really profitability becomes much higher here compared to other places in the world because we have a flat tax right now, whereas most places have a progressive tax. Anyway, I don't know that you want to talk more about that, but I promised to get that to the committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none right now. Representative Guerra, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me discuss the gross tax bill that we've put together. It's a modification of the law that we have right now. And as you'll see, it's fairly straightforward. And what I want to emphasize is that this isn't the only way to do it. What I want to emphasize is Senator Wagner has a way to do it, Representative Crawford and Croft have a way to do it, we have a way to do it, and you can all come up with ways to do it. As Dr. Van Uhr said yesterday, you come up with the revenue goal that you want at various prices and the investment incentives you want at various prices. And what you do is you come up with a tax rate, a sliding scale tax rate, taking into account the credits you're going to allow so that you're left with the amount of revenue you project. And I would recommend to do something that I think this legislature would want would be let's take maybe the revenue projections for the PPT version that any of you favored. Maybe let's say it's 23.5%, the one that passed the House. Take the revenue projections that were listed by Econ One that people thought were desirable and do a gross tax bill that raises more than that but with the credits and deductions gets down to that level. And I think we could do that in short order. I mean, the numbers, you'd play around with the numbers with, you know, help from Econ One or Dr. Van Muren of the Department of Revenue, and you can come up with a bill at the various prices that raises roughly what maybe a PPT that you wanted raises, with the advantage, for those of you who believe that a profits tax is not the desirable way to go, with the advantage that we go back to a verifiable gross tax. So that's the goal here, is to let you know the numbers are easily movable so you can get to where you want to go. And I believe, I tend to agree with Dr. Van Muren yesterday. What he said was, really, there's only a certain amount that the tax rate is going to affect investment decisions. To him, what's going to affect investment decisions is if there's a monetary reward for investing. So what he said was, once you give the companies the credit, the carrot of the credit, they may try and reduce their tax rate by taking advantage of the credit rules. I think it's a fair point. And Dr. Van Muren is a little mistaken. There's a credit in this bill, and we'll go through it. I don't think anybody's mind is going to change at this point over whether we should do a gross tax or a profits tax. Many people, I think the public, has been swayed. I feel that that doing a tax based on a percentage of a verifiable number, the sales price of oil, is more fair to the state than doing a percentage of profits. But folks are just as educated on this issue as I am, so I'm not going to spend any time on that. Currently, what we do under current laws, we tax based on a percentage of the sales price of oil, minus transportation costs and a couple other costs. So we call that the wellhead price, right? That's the price they sell it on the West Coast for, let's say, minus the cost of transporting it from the processing facility on the North Slope. One of the problems with going along the lines of doing a PPT is it banks, it bets the state's future on high prices. At $60 a barrel, assuming the companies report profits the way that the projections say they will, at $60 a barrel, we do okay under, let's say, the House version that passed. You get down to $40 a barrel, and then after all the gas deductions, once the gas line starts, the profits from PPT above what we have right now essentially almost all get eaten up, and below $35 or $32 a barrel, we lose money under PPT. So I think it depends on your assessment on what oil prices are going to be in the future. The Energy Information Administration inaccurately predicts oil prices every year. This year's prediction is somewhere around $45, $47 a barrel for the long term, inflation adjusted. BP, a couple of weeks ago, issued their prediction, which is oil prices of about $40 a barrel. I have no way of guessing better than these folks do. But let's just assume BP is correct. When Econ One came to Anchorage in mid-June, they presented the second slide they presented was this one. And this one shows that we can expect somewhere around along the lines of $9.2 billion in gas field costs, apart from building the pipeline, the ones that are deductible and creditable under PPT. So the processing facilities, the feeder pipelines, they assume that's going to cost somewhere around $9.2 billion. Under PPT, 40% of that is deductible or creditable. The state will pay roughly $4 billion of that. Well, what does PPT do at $40 a barrel? When we saw the projections from Econ One, they said their projections don't include the deductions and the credits for when the gas line starts. And PPT at $40 a barrel raises what they say is about $490 million a year, depending on the various versions, over the status quo, over the next 10 years. So over the next 10 years, the governor's PPT would raise about $4.9 billion, assuming the companies report profits the way we assume they will. 40% of that $9.2 billion in gas field costs is $3.7 billion. So under the governor's PPT at $40 a barrel, you're left with, over the long term, about $1.2 billion over the course of 10 years in additional revenue. So it's about $120 million a year extra over the status quo. Isn't that much. I mean, almost all of that gets eaten up by gas line costs, and that's one of the problems many of us feel exists with allowing gas costs to be deducted from your oil tax. And many people have called for us to separate the whole issue of the gas tax and gas credits from the oil tax and oil credits. This is the Wood Mackenzie chart. It generally shows that Alaska is a more profitable place to invest than most places in the world, especially as prices get up above $22 a barrel. Even at $22 a barrel, the global average company internal rate of return is about 19%. In Alaska, it's about 24%, and that gap rises as prices go higher. Wood Mackenzie, when they did this 2 years ago, we were talking about $40 a barrel being high. Now we're talking about $70 a barrel being average. The fix to the current system, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about how the current system works, because we've been talking in this PPT world, so we've analyzed how a profits tax would work, but we have to spend a little bit of time talking about how the ELF works so we know how to fix it. And it really is straightforward. Dr. Van Ures has a proposal that Senator Wagner has been handing out today that he proposed to the last two administrations, we'll hear more about that. The intention of the ELF makes sense. The idea is that smaller fields and older fields are less profitable than newer, larger fields. But the way we've imposed the ELF hasn't made so much sense. What we have under the ELF system is we have a production tax. It's a percentage of the gross value of oil, the wellhead value, and it's a 15% tax on almost all fields. The first couple of years, it's 12.5%, so companies can recover some of their investment, and by the fourth or fifth year, I believe, it becomes 15%. You take that tax, and for each field is assigned an ELF number. between 0 and 1. A field with a 1 elf pays the full 15% tax, 1 times 15. A field with a 0 elf pays no production tax, 0 times 15. And the elf tries to factor in the size of the field, the per well production on the field, things like that. But it's not calibrated so well. First of all, if you have a 0% field, let's say profits are thin on a small field at $10 a barrel, that remains 0% when oil goes to 20, 30, 40. When oil goes to 60 and $100 a barrel, the elf remains zero on those fields. The tax rate doesn't change on fields as prices go up. And that's what Dan Dickinson has said in the past. The oil companies have said it in the past when prices have dropped. The elf doesn't take into account the impact of price. At lower prices, the tax should go down. At higher prices, the tax should go up. And by doing that, if you did that, you can mimic a profits tax. You can make the elf more favorable to companies at low prices and let the state share in windfall profits and higher profits at higher prices. And just as a historical footnote, it used to be the companies that would complain that we needed oil tax reform back when oil was $9 a barrel and Prudhoe Bay was still charging a 13% tax rate. The cry was that the elf should allow the tax rate to change with price. Here's the problem with the elf. It's calibrated in a way where even though the elf is designed to promote production at small fields, only three fields in the state now pay a production tax. Prudhoe Bay pays about 12%. So you take the 15% tax, and Prudhoe Bay is like a 0.8 elf. So 0.8 times 15%, they get to a 12% tax. North Star, about 6%. Alpine, 12%. Every other field in the state pays either zero or a fraction above zero. I think Kaparik pays something like 0.0 something. Next year. Well, we're charging a 0% tax on some of the largest fields in the country. The federal government ranks the size of fields nationwide. Kaparik, second largest field actually on the continent, paying a 0% tax at $60 a barrel. Tarn, 67th largest field, Endicott, Milne Point, a couple of the large fields. WESAC is a heavy oil field, so maybe there's an argument they should pay a lower tax. But every field in the state, most of the state's production is taxed at a 0% production tax. You know, a lot of us have had to bite our lips as we've listened to the ads on TV where people say we're tripling their production tax. We're more than tripling the production tax on the 0% fields. I mean, the elf is so out of whack that it needs to be multiplied compared to what it is right now for us to get even close to a fair share. The other flaw with the elf is that it taxes you, it gives you an elf rate based on your particular field. Well, Tarn, for example, is located a couple miles away from Kaparik. It's a satellite field. When they consider what Tarn's elf rate should be, they don't combine Tarn with Kaparik. They don't aggregate. So this is Kaparik. That's Tarn. That's what Tarn looks like. Couple drilling sites, three 10-mile pipelines to Kaparik. It's considered a standalone field, a small field, even though it's connected to the second largest field on the continent. And at $70 a barrel, it's paying a 0% tax. It's one of the largest fields in the United States. If we do nothing, and you'll see this in these Econ 1 projection charts as to what PPT would raise, the elf is going down every year. As fields dwindle in production, as they get older, as newer fields that are small come in to replace Prudhoe Bay, which is large, the average elf on the North Slope, or the average tax rate on the North Slope is shrinking. In 1993, it was about 13.5% across the board. Then the satellite fields like Tarn started to come on board, and so we started charging all of them a 0% production tax. I think 11 of the last 14 fields to come online pay a 0% production tax. This year, the average tax rate is about 7.5%. This comes from the Department of Revenue source book, and it's projected by 2015 to fall to about 1.5%. And I just want to caution people on this. That's why the Econ 1 charts only go so far as they do. They project how much more the PPT versions raise than current law over the next 10 years. So let's say I think the 23.5% version that we passed in the House, they projected at $60 a barrel would raise about $2.3 billion more than current law. But that's not this year. That's not this coming year. It's that much more than current law because current law 10 years out is almost zero. So by comparing what the PPT versions raise compared to current law, the gap is very big, not necessarily because PPT is raising so much extra money, but because the ELF rate is going so low that compared to the low ELF rate, the PPT versions are raising a lot of money. I would venture that at $40 a barrel, the governor's PPT 10 years from now will raise less money than we're raising right now under ELF. And there's some good reasons for that. We'll have less production 10 years from now. But just be aware of the numbers in the Econ 1 charts. It was a fair way for them to do it, but a lot of people are surprised to find out that next year we'll be receiving a lot less money under PPT than we do under that 10-year average that is projected in the Econ 1 charts. I have to admit I share the view of some of those who have come before us and said we should probably have two separate tax systems, one for the existing fields and one for new fields. The existing fields were designed to be profitable at $15 a barrel, $18 a barrel, $20 a barrel. The price average over the years before 2002 was in the 20s and 18s and 16s. And so when you developed a field, you expected those prices. I think, you know, we're asking people to do frontier development right now, more expensive development. It may be that the fields that we develop from here on out are going to be tested at higher prices to be profitable. This has been a statement you've seen before. BP repeated it again last year. They believe at $20 a barrel they receive enough excess profit that they have a special shareholder dividend program and a special a share buyback program whenever oil exceeds $20 a barrel. At $20 a barrel, they have said they've met their investment needs, their capital needs, their cost needs, and above that, they therefore distribute a lot more to shareholders. AOGA said the cost of getting oil out of the ground into market here is about $12 a barrel, $13 a barrel. Some people have said $10, but you can use that as a thumbnail. We've heard some statements during the testimony that at $30 a barrel, the oil companies are suffering. BP and Conoco report their Alaska profits. Exxon doesn't. But what we know, and it surprised me very much when I'd hear how skinny profits are even at $40 a barrel for the existing fields. That might be true for new, smaller frontier fields. But in 2002, we had the lowest recent annual oil price. It was about $25 a barrel. At $25 a barrel, Conoco took in close to a 30% profit margin. BP took in about a 23.5% profit margin. And when I say profit margin, I mean the profits as a percentage of their total sales. So, and we've heard some testimony that companies are testing projects to make sure that they generate internal rates of return of 15-20% or so. And I think so the profit margin number I think is useful. Of course, as prices go up, the profit margins jump. BP last year took in over a 50% profit margin. These are, if you look at company reports on Wall Street, company reports on Wall Street will show profit margin something closer to 10 or 15% or 5% for larger companies. Granted, oil companies seek a higher rate of return, especially exploration companies, than GE does, for example. But these have been the numbers in Alaska, 30 to 50% profit margins generally. The Department of Revenue has, and this is a sheet that we handed out, the Department of Revenue has provided this projection for us. It shows what the revenue split is between the state and the oil companies at various prices, and it also shows in various prior years what the revenue split has been. They show company net revenue, which for shorthand is profit, and they show state revenue, total state revenue, royalty, production tax, corporate tax, property tax. In 2005, they estimated corporate net revenue to be about $5.2 billion for Alaska Oil. About $3.2 billion was the state share. So about a $2 billion gap. Just a brief note on profits. The Department of Revenue says they can estimate what company excess cash is, corporate net revenue, how much money they make in excess of their costs, their exploration costs, their operation costs, their development costs. They don't know company depreciation schedules, so sort of non-tangible deductions they don't include in their net revenue numbers. That's why they don't call them profit numbers. But their profit numbers from a layman standpoint, the money they make in excess of their annual costs. Based on the sales value of the oil produced on the North Slope last year, about $13 billion, according to the Department of Revenue. Company net revenue, $5.2 billion. In FY05, the profit margin on the North Slope was somewhere around 40%. We don't have the numbers in for this year yet, but we do have an estimate from the Department of Revenue showing next year, based on various prices of oil, what can we expect state revenue to be, what can we expect company revenue to be. Next year, the production numbers are going to be lower than they were last year, so these numbers are a little bit understated. But plugging in next year's production numbers at this year's annual price, this past year oil averaged about $62 a barrel, according to the Department of Revenue. Companies are on pace to take about $7 billion in profit. The state will probably tally up that it took about $4 billion in revenue. That's so about a $2.5-3 billion gap between the two this year. That would leave about a profit margin on the North Slope of about 40% again. One of the things HB 3004 does is and I apologize, in the charts the Department of Revenue has handed out that show the revenue split under this bill, they refer to it as HB 63, because as we were drafting this latest version, we were changing things that were in HB 63, but we didn't have a bill number yet. So you'll see the HB 63 referenced here, but it's HB 3004. What does this bill do in terms of revenue generation? It equalizes the shares a lot better between the state and between the producers. At $60 a barrel, for example, I wish I had a pointer, but I don't know how to do that. I could use my cell phone. At $60 a barrel, let's say, go down to the bottom half of that chart, and that's the projections under HB 3004. At $60 a barrel, and I'll tell you how HB 3004 works in a moment, company net revenue, company profit would still remain about $5.5 billion on Alaska production, about $5.8 billion for the state share, close to a 50-50 split. We'd leave company net profit margins at about 33%, quite healthy. They'd be roughly equal at $80 a barrel again. Where would they be at $80 a barrel if we do nothing? Company net revenue of about $10 billion, the state would get about half that if we don't do anything. We equalize the shares. Equalizing the shares, you know, it sounds great, and perhaps it should be a goal, but really the goal should be leaving the state with a fair share and making sure the companies are able to generate enough revenue that they can continue to invest in the state, continue to hire in the state, and continue to operate. Enough, but not way more than that. So at $20 a barrel, our bill leaves things the way they are, very close to the way they are under current, about 11% profit margin. At $40 a barrel, we take a little bit more than the companies under our bill. We take a bit less than the companies under current law. One of the things I'd note is you know, we're still leaving very large company profit margins at all of the price levels that we expect to see in the future, $40, $50, $60 a barrel. There could be a good case could be made that the state should take a larger share at those prices. With the gross tax, depending on how you do it and the way we do it, we leave the state with a fair slice at low prices, at $20 a barrel, more than the companies take. You could decide not to take such a fair slice at $20 a barrel, and then, but I think the trade-off would have to be that the state should take a much more substantial share at high prices. In Norway, for example, the state's always taking over 70%. But it's, you know, again, this bill can be rewritten depending on what your own sense of fairness tells you. Like I said, we'd still leave above $26 a barrel company profit margins of about 20% and over 30% as prices rise above $40 a barrel. Interestingly, the numbers, the profit margin numbers don't change that much from current law because, remember, for every dollar the oil companies pay to the state, 35 cents of that is paid by the federal government because of the federal tax code. And that's why changing the tax rate, I think, has very minimal impact on small changes to the tax rate have very minimal impacts on the company bottom line. Let me go to the mechanics of how the fair share bill would work. And it's very close. I had a conversation with Dr. Van Meers in the hallway yesterday. And I think today they're distributing the bill that he wrote for Governor Murkowski earlier in his administration, for Governor Knowles before that. You know, there didn't seem to be a lot of appetite to go ahead with those things in Juneau until recently. I think it's really good that we're going ahead now. But the approaches are quite similar. And honestly, I spent a fair amount of time working with Department of Revenue people early on in putting these proposals together, and it's probably why the proposals look so similar. What our bill does is it says for those fields that pay anything over a 5% tax, and it's only three fields, North Star, Alpine, and Prudhoe Bay, any field that pays over a 5% tax, that tax remains their base tax. It'll go higher at high prices, lower at low prices, but that tax will remain the same. So the ELF won't be changed for those three large fields. But for fields that pay nothing, we're going to establish a minimum tax. And we set the minimum at a modest 5% tax. We could set the minimum at a higher tax and start progressivity later. What we've done is set it at a lower rate and start progressivity earlier at the same point that Dr. Van Meers had originally suggested to start progressivity, which was $20 a barrel, taking into account that the fields online right now were designed to be profitable at 15, 16, 18. So 5% minimum tax, that'll apply to almost every field on the North Slope except for the biggest three. Dr. Van Meer's proposal was that, I believe he explained to me, he was going to leave the tax rate the same on the largest fields also and come up with a minimum by changing the L formula for the smaller fields. Both of our proposals will differ from what you hear as the Shelf the Elf proposal. The Shelf the Elf proposal is just a straightforward couple sentence fix to the current law. And what it says is, look, fields pay a 15% tax and then you adjust that by the Elf factor. They say get rid of the Elf factor. And so every field would pay 15% all the time at low prices, at high prices. That's Shelf the Elf, and our proposal was aimed to be much more flexible, much more price sensitive, much more profit sensitive than the Shelf the Elf proposals, which I think are not flexible enough. Senator Wagner, Representative Crawford and Croft have also, I believe what they do is they exempt a certain number of barrels from every field from the tax, and so therefore protect the small fields from a tax. That's the approach that they'll go ahead with, which I think also makes some sense, just another way of doing it. So under our bill, Prudhoe Bay would still pay a 12% tax, Alpine still 12%, North Star still 6%, and then you bring in the price factor. Dr. Van Meers had proposed starting progressivity at $20 a barrel. I'm not sure if you reduce taxes also at lower prices. Ours does below $16 a barrel. And the progressivity factor that we went with, though certainly it could be changed to the kind of progressivity factors we've discussed this session, which is a certain percentage for every dollar a barrel increase. Ours is the progressivity factor is the price of oil over 20. So when oil is $30 a barrel, it's 30 over 20. You multiply the tax rate by 30 over 20 or 1.5. At 21 over 20, there's barely any progressivity. At 40 over 20, you double the tax, so the small fields will be paying a 10% tax, still quite a modest tax, and Prudhoe Bay would be paying about 26%. What we do also is make sure that we protect the company upside. I think they want to know as they do something very close to gambling on in the business that they operate, they want to know at very high prices that there's going to be a high upside. We've capped the tax rate, the gross tax rate, at 27.5%. So at $100 a barrel or at $60 a barrel, Prudhoe Bay is going to pay a 26% tax. For the 5% fields, it's going to take them a while to get up to 25%, somewhere over $100 a barrel. But the big fields, they're going to get to that 27% at about $50 a barrel or so. And then we provide that as the price of oil falls below $16 a barrel. Remember, AOGA's estimate is it costs about $12 a barrel in the state to produce oil. At $16 a barrel and below, we reduce the tax by a similar price factor. And we reduce it much more quickly for the smaller fields that pay the 5% minimum tax. They'll pay a 0% tax by the time oil falls to $11 a barrel. The Department of Revenue has estimated the effective tax rate, the gross tax rate we would charge at various prices. See, the problem under ELF is it'll remain 7.8% at every price ever. If oil falls to $10 a barrel, it's still 7.8%, and they lose money. If oil goes up to $100 a barrel, it's still 7.8%. The average tax rate under our bill at current prices is somewhere around 22%. $60 a barrel is 21%. $80 a barrel is 23% because of the progressivity factor. We have an additional protection that says if oil ever falls below $10 a barrel, half of your production tax is going to be waived. There won't be very much in the way of production taxes at $10 a barrel. And then half you can defer. And at that point, at $10 a barrel, we're really relying on our royalty, really. I mean, that's what's keeping the state afloat at $10 a barrel. Dr. Van Meers made a mistake yesterday when he mentioned that the bill doesn't include tax credits. The bill extends the SB 185 credits that we adopted a few years ago. And so those provide for a 20 to 40% tax credit for new exploration, depending on how far it is away from an existing well. And, you know, that can certainly be changed. You know, I think you can do the full spectrum of inaccuracy on tax credits. You can provide too little tax credit, or you can provide too much. I think it's providing too much when you start giving companies a credit for something they were going to do anyway. I mean, I think the flat 40% tax credit and deduction that we give under PPT that you get even if you're going to just invest the same $1 billion a year that's been invested over the past 5 years. So if you invest the same amount of money that you were going to do without tax credits and we're giving you a 40% credit, I think that that's an overly generous credit. I think SB 185 took an interesting approach. They said, we're only going to give you a credit when you start exploring for new fields that are not right next to the fields that you are developing right now. And the further away, the higher the credit goes. It was an interesting approach. I think I would extend it. I would recommend we extend it to also allowing a credit for new investment that's aimed to extend the life of an aging field. I think that's important, too. Dr. Van Meers' point really was the credit is what causes companies to try and invest in order to avoid a tax burden. And I think there needs to be some credit mechanism inside the bill. Heavy oil, there are certainly a number of ways you can deal with heavy oil. And we've essentially left it blank because we knew the committee would have their own ideas on what to do on heavy oil. This bill right now exempts heavy oil at less than 20 degrees. But certainly we can take different approaches on heavy oil. I think one that makes sense is something that you're going to see that's in this bill. I think you should charge a tax rate to heavy oil and then ask the companies to come to the state as they're allowed to right now and say, look, this project is uneconomic unless you give us a royalty break or a tax break. So I'll get to that in a little bit. That's the way I would do it. There's a tax relief provision in this bill that tries to come up with the balance between providing too much in the way of credits and not enough in the way of credits. Right now we have a law called royalty relief, as you all know, and it says if a company comes to the state with clear evidence and shows that it needs a reduction in its royalty to make a field profitable, we'll give it to them. There haven't been a lot of royalty relief applications in recent years because, well, oil's been $30, $40, $50, $60, $70 a barrel. It's hard to make the case that tax relief is needed on most new development. What we say is, look, it may be that we've come up with a new production tax that in some case is going to be too high. So in addition to being able to get royalty relief, we'll use the same standards on the books to allow you to get severance tax relief too, production tax relief too. Show us that you need the tax break and you'll get it. If you don't need it, you're not going to get it. And I think that's probably the best way to protect the state. And I think that's probably what we should use for heavy oil. Show us on this year's technology that you need a tax break, or 10 years from now, show us based on the technology that's available 10 years from now that you need a tax break. Present us the case for that field instead of asking us to come up with a number today without even knowing the geology of the field. Show us you need it, and you'll get it. And I think, you know, in the last year, we've seen that the administration has been willing to grant royalty relief on the North Slope, and I anticipate it would be willing to grant it whenever it's needed. I think this is the greatest unspoken need on the North Slope if we're ever going to see a lot of new development. It's facilities access. And I know a number of legislators on both sides of the aisle have talked about it. I think we really do need to talk about this. I don't think it's, I'll let Mark Myers defend himself. I've heard him in the past say the one thing you can do on the North Slope to spur new investment that would be as effective or more effective than anything else would be facilities access. And why is that? Well, one way to encourage new investment is to make sure you're leaving a high enough company profit margin that money is available to invest. But as company profit margins have tripled over the last 5 years, investments remain the same. So making cash flow available isn't the only answer. It isn't even an answer. The most expensive, I believe, I'll stand corrected that it's one of the most expensive, but I think the most expensive piece of equipment on the North Slope that you need to develop in order to develop an oil field is a processing facility. Right, to separate the oil from the water, a processing facility can cost upwards of $100 million or more. The reason why the small field development on the North Slope has been a big company game is because of what we saw in Tarn. They've been able to develop the satellite fields on the North Slope, the small fields located right next to very large processing facilities at Prudhoe Bay, at Kaparik. And the reason those are economic is they can pipe the oil 3 miles, 5 miles, 10 miles over to the existing processing facility that they own, and the field becomes economic. Pioneer has never once been granted facilities access. They can't use BP's or Conoco's or Exxon. I don't know if Exxon owns processing facilities on the North Slope, but they can't use the existing processing facilities. Since they can't use them, when they have to add the $100 million price tag to a project on a small oil field, they decide not to go ahead with it. In the leases right now, there are facility access provisions. They've never been enforced, and the understanding is that small developers have never been given sort of the offer at a reasonable rate to use a processing facility that they've needed. So I think not once in the history of the state has a small a producer been allowed to use the facilities to produce oil on the North Slope owned by one of the majors. Well, is that fair? Is that a fair thing to do, to ask the majors to make their facilities available to small producers? Well, it's fair to the state if we want extra economic development on the North Slope, and to make it fair to industry, you would have to make sure that that the North Slope producers were given a fair price for the use of their processing facilities. We do that in the utilities world already between competitors. The rule used within the RCA right now is that they make the facility available at a reasonable rate, which is interpreted to mean a reasonable profit. You have to also make sure there's available capacity. I mean, BP shouldn't be forced to give Pioneer access to a facility that's processing at capacity. So if there's capacity available...
Isn't that what the problem is today?
What's that?
Is that not the biggest problem that we have today, is capacity?
That there's under
capacity. The problem that we have with production today on the North Slope is that we're not able to re-inject the volume of gas that we're receiving from the existing wells through the processing plant to re-inject back downhole, that's where the bottleneck is at. So if you use your theory, and I think there should be open access to other companies into some of these larger facilities, but if the issue currently is that we can't re-inject all the gas that we are bringing up today because we're not bringing up the percentage of oil out of the ground as we used to, that the gas facilities are strictly limited now by the number of wells that they have in production.
I mean, if you're right that they're all operating in full capacity and there's no room, then the sort of whispers we hear from the small producers that they think they're being denied fair access to processing facilities are wrong. It's a really hard debate to have because the small producers don't ever want to go public and take on the BPs who they need help from, the Conocos that they need help from, and the Exxons that they need help from, right? I mean, it's the biggest issue that's never been discussed around here for a reason. If that turns out to be the case, that each of the processing facilities on the North Slope are operating at full capacity for the owners at that point, I don't think it would be fair to require them to decrease their own access in order to provide it for somebody else. But I think at some point we should hear from people on facilities access. But that has been former director of the division of oil and gas, Mark Myers, testimony in the past. He says tinkering around with the tax rate and tax credits are only going to get you so far. If you want more development, you need to make the North Slope a friendlier place for independent producers, and this is the thing that he has talked about for a long time.
And along those lines, we need to I won't say it right now, but go ahead, Les.
Okay. The point that many of us have talked about is that the current system that just keeps making more and more and more cash flow available to companies because the tax rate is inadequate is not leading to more investment. You've seen statements that companies have had more money than they're willing to invest, and that's why they're adopting new shareholder programs. It's an indication that we're giving away way too much money that oil companies are adopting new shareholder dividend programs. The money that we should be receiving as our share is being held internally for things other than investment, things other than exploration, things other than development. And that's when I believe you should know that you're under taxing. Based upon the Department of Revenue's estimates of company net revenue, what I refer to in shorthand as company profit, FY 2002 company revenue from Alaska production was about $1.7 billion. It's tripled by FY 05 to $5.2 billion. This year it should be around $7 billion, so quadrupled. And the level of company investment on the North Slope has remained about $1 billion a year. So I hope people think about that seriously as they sort of consider this issue of how much money you need to leave available for the producers and what impact that's going to have on their investment decisions. It hasn't had any in the last 5 years. If we don't do anything to fix the ELP this session, we're going to leave another $2 billion on the table, another $2 billion that some of us would use for savings, some of us would use for schools, and that none of us will ever see again. I think the legislature should consider a fair exploration credit, something that will encourage new exploration, but sort of take into account the idea that we don't want to subsidize activities that were going to take place even without the credit. I think we should heed Dr. Van Muir's advice, and we all know this is true, which is you can adjust the gross tax that we have in this bill to one that generates a different revenue level that you think should be generated at $40, $60, $80 a barrel. I would think that you should subject heavy oil to whatever tax we come up with but give heavy oil producers the option for royalty relief and for severance tax relief. They can come to us, show us they need a better tax rate, and we'll provide it to them. Dr. Van Mieris agreed yesterday that our number one priority, or at least one of our greatest priorities, I forget the words exactly, is to stop the bleeding, right? To stop the bleeding that sees us lose so much state revenue every year by doing nothing, by letting most of our oil leave the state at a 0% tax. And then I would offer it to you, if my fear is people are going to say we only have 2 weeks left, and we can't craft a new oil tax scheme in these last 2 weeks if we haven't been able to in the first 4.5 or 5 months. What we do know is the existing fields are fields that we're losing a huge amount of money on, $2 billion a year the last couple of years. We can come up with a fair tax scheme for the existing fields this year, leave new production subject to the existing laws that are in place, and come back with the new 120-day session next year and come up with a fair tax rate to encourage new exploration and to apply it to new fields. I think at a minimum, we have to come up with a tax rate this session that gives the state at least a fair share of the record profits that are being generated at Kuparuk, at Prudhoe Bay, at Alpine, at the other places on the North Slope. That's not my preferred alternative, to come up with only a tax plan that addresses the existing fields, but that is one of our biggest priorities, which is to stop the bleeding. Stop the bleeding to the tune of about $2 billion last year. And I think by any measure, oil tax reform is needed. Current law, it exempts most taxes, including the second largest field on the continent, from any production tax. The ELF applies even when companies are earning windfall profits. Profit shares, profit margins at any anticipated price are just massive in the state. And if you look at the company reports statewide and nationwide, the profit margins that are reported in Alaska vastly exceed their profit margins worldwide. I looked at one of the large companies' annual profit statement, and worldwide they were generating a 10 or 15% profit margin, but in Alaska they were generating a 40% profit margin. And I think that goes some ways to answering the question that we've heard many times now. Are we making oil investment in the state profitable enough? Well, about triple profitable enough, about three times as profitable as other places are, apparently. But in any case, quite generously profitable. And if we do nothing this year, it's going to be nothing, I think, to the detriment of our schools or our savings. And that last statement, I think, probably everybody here agrees with. So there are easy ways to fix the ELF. There are straightforward ways to fix the ELF. We don't have to come up with a brand new tax scheme. We don't have to come up with a scheme that risks that our tax is going to be based on a profit number that we don't trust. With that, I'll just take questions from folks.
Any questions? Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things that come to mind. First of all, you stress that the profit margins are so great up here for the oil companies, but then just, I guess, basic economics would tell me then they should be investing all sorts of money up here to if profits are so great, but yet the investments have actually been going down. Why is that?
Well, the one thing we know is they are great, and the other thing we know is that they've been increasing, and the other thing we know is just what you said, that investment hasn't, as profits have gone up, oil companies haven't been investing here. And I think I've heard a number of times that geology is more important than tax rate. We can't do anything really to impact the geology up here. I believe that the producible oil in Alaska will be produced, but this whole rush to reduce the tax rate low enough or increase the subsidies high enough to make sure it's developed next year instead of 5 years from now, I don't know that that's something we should be doing. If our oil fields are slated for exploration and development on a schedule over the next 20 years, making sure that we give away more money to get it developed next year as opposed to in 2010 or 2012, I don't think gets us anywhere, and I don't know that we can cause the oil companies to shuffle their exploration schedule in the state. I mean, if we could cause them to shuffle their exploration schedule in the state, Alaska has been much more attractive in terms of tax rate and profit margins than most places in the world at these recent prices. Companies should be flocking here if it was the tax rate and the incentives that drive their investment decisions. But I think geology plays a huge role in it. And when I was traveling in Europe a few years ago, there was an article in a British newspaper, and they were asking the same question about the declining North Slope field or North Sea fields. And there was a pretty compelling argument that that there's not a huge amount you can do in terms of tax incentives and tax rates to shuffle future project plans. I believe you probably can some, but I also think it also benefits the state to have something come online 15 years from now for the next generation, as it does to take the oil now for this generation. I mean, we've got a problem, especially 10 and 15 years out, and I think it's just as good for the state, maybe even better, to make sure new oil is coming into the pipeline 10 and 15 years from now for the next generation, so they have a stable revenue stream as we do today. So I wouldn't pay a lot of money to speed up the schedule.
If I can follow up on that, I hope 15 to 20 years from now we're not using oil. I hope we're using natural gas, hydrology, solar, other alternatives. And I think we're actually I think we're progressing in that area. And obviously, a dollar today is worth a lot more than a dollar 20 years from now. So I would respectfully disagree with you that we can hold off on producing our oil for another 15 to 20 years. I don't think it'll be worth near as much, nor will we get as much for it then as we would today. But you do mention, I don't think you quite answered my question as to why the oil companies aren't flocking up here, because you know you said that, according to you, it's very profitable up here for them. And you know the capitalistic society we live in would say that they should be flocking up here. But you said that the difficult geology has something to do with it. So then obviously that adds to their expense. If the geology that they're working in is difficult, then that makes it more expensive for them to get the oil out of the ground, which indeed then does impact their profitability. But one thing I would like to bring up, you talk about the Band-Aid and or stopping the bleeding, and I agree with you. But I think, unfortunately, the governor doesn't get much credit for this, and I don't know why, because I know the oil companies hated it when he did it, but I think it was just about a year ago, through administrative action, he incorporated some of the marginal fields into Prudhoe Bay. Now, these marginal fields were not paying any taxes, and now that they're being incorporated into the Prudhoe Bay unit, they are paying a tax that we weren't getting before. And do you know how much additional revenue that has brought in? I've heard up to $200 million.
Yeah, in the first year, it brought in about $100 million, and I think given the oil prices, it's brought in something probably closer to $200 million. I did give him credit when he did that. I thought that was a step in the direction we'd been pushing for a long time. I thought also what he did was he took the satellite fields, which are sort of standing alone as artificial standalone fields that we all knew were really part of Prudhoe Bay, and said they should be calculated as part of Prudhoe Bay. I think we should do that at Alpine and Kuparuk too. The governor probably, it was really interesting, I think he taxed those fields by making those 0% fields of Prudhoe Bay 13% fields by making them part of Prudhoe Bay. He imposed a tax at that point that I actually thought might arguably be too high. I think the right tax at the prices that were there at that time, probably the right tax now, but you know, if oil ever fell to $10 a barrel, a 13% tax on those fields maybe didn't make sense. But that's not his fault. That's the inflexibility of the ELF. And he did what he could under the regulatory authority he had. I think it makes sense. It's one of the problems with the ELF is the problem he addressed on Prudhoe Bay, but not on Kuparuk and Alpine, which is you have standalone fields that really aren't standalone fields, that really should be integrated with the unit and pay the tax at the tax of the larger field. Senator Frentz and I give credit when he did that.
How do you define a standalone field? I mean, or a satellite field? Does it have to be so many miles away from the processing facilities, or Because as Dr. Van Meers mentioned yesterday, and this is part of the problem, and I think this is what you're mentioning, is the geology. You have, you know, all these oil fields basically overlay each other. Some of them are on top of each other, and some of them are miles apart, but yet they're close enough where through pipes they can use the existing facilities. Do you have some sort of definition on a satellite field?
This is what I know on satellite fields, is people within the Department of Revenue and Department of Law for a long time have been saying the fields that we're letting be taxed as independent standalone fields at a 0% tax rate under the current statute should be defined as part of the overall field. But the interpretation of the departments as they've issued and approved the leases on those fields is that the department has decided to let them operate as standalone 0% fields. So my understanding from the attorneys and those who've spoken to me from within the state is the current law allows us to define those fields as part of the bigger unit. But the way the law has been interpreted, they've been allowed to be standalone fields. So. But I think my guess is the definition is loose enough, not black and white enough, that there's room for argument on both sides, and that's why you have the current system. I couldn't sitting here tell you how you should define them, right? But generally, the law is if they're an integrated economic unit, it should be one field. Not if there's just one pool of oil, but if they're an integrated economic unit, roughly, it should be one field. And, you know, but it's a gray area right now whether Tarn, which is 10 miles away from Kaparik, is an integrated economic unit because it's connected by a pipe. I don't think the definition should be a contiguous pool of oil, probably. That's probably too simple. I don't know the answer to how it should be defined. And you said before, you know, how come I say corporate profits have gone up but investments haven't? I'm not saying corporate profits have gone up. They have. I mean, it's Department of Revenue. They've quadrupled in the last 4 years, and investment has stayed the same. I don't know why the oil companies aren't investing more. I'm giving you my best estimate as to why they are, but leaving more money on the table for them doesn't work.
It's a good point, and it's something I hear from my constituents all the time, is that the profits are so huge up here for the oil companies. Why aren't we taxing them more? And again, just my basic business background tells me if the profits are so great up here, then why don't we have every oil company in the world up here? In fact, until recently, it was just BP, Exxon, and ConocoPhillips. Just of late, Anarko and some of the Pioneer and some of the smaller ones have started to come up. But when we talk about profits, and it is irritating because, you know, we all have to buy gas at the pump. Now, have we compared the profits with the oil industry with other industries that we really don't have much choice? I mean, you mentioned GE, but, you know, whether I buy a GE light bulb or somebody else's, I do have a choice. What about, like, the pharmaceutical or maybe the software industry? How does the profit margins compare there with the oil industry?
I've looked. When I started this work 3 years ago, I looked at a lot of large companies. And the Pfizers of the world, I mean, as you know, year to year, the profit margins change radically at these companies. There's no industry other than the sort of dot-com type industries or whatever today's version of the dot-coms are. There are no industries that generate 40% profit margins, essentially none. Just oil in Alaska not just oil in Alaska, but certainly oil in Alaska, and oil in Alaska stands out. We're generating, just look at Pfizer, look at Merck, look at... You know, you're not going to see profit margins like that. You're going to see profit margins in the 5, 10, 20% range is huge. But certainly there are exceptions. I looked at a number of companies in different industries, and these are just dot-com numbers.
Okay. And I don't have the numbers to argue with you. But I think you said the 40% profit, that's at today's high oil prices, which we know is not always the case. Your bill isn't truly a gross bill because you're encouraging incentives and credits to be added to this. So doesn't that kind of get us back to a net bill? What's the difference? Go ahead.
It gets you back to the good part of a net bill, but it doesn't get you back to the bad part of a net bill. The good part of the net bill is that you should have a tax that that is higher when profits are high and lower when profits are low, that doesn't discourage investments when profits are low, that results in a fair share when there's a lot of money on the table. That's the good part of a net bill. And the bad part of a net bill is you only tax a percentage of profits. And I don't have a lot of confidence that Exxon and Conoco and BP are going to report profits the way I think they should be reported. You know, I run a really small fishing rating business, and I was told early on that I could deduct the cost of my fishing gear, that I could buy a new fly rod and deduct that from the money that I make on my writing. I've never done that. I think that's absurd. But we all know, we've all received tax advice over the years that pushes the margin. And I think a large company has a duty to push the margins. Right? I mean, the law in every state is a company's main duty is to its shareholders. Their duty is to push the margin on tax reporting. So that's the danger that you face when you tax profits. I think the bigger problem, frankly, I could almost stomach taxing profits. I mean, you could come up with a way to tax profits if you limited the deductions and the credits very carefully. But when I found out that that we're going to pay about $4 billion for gas field development after the pipeline is built out of our oil taxes, that's a lot of money. I mean, I think once the pipeline is built, companies are going to want to develop the gas fields. It's the pipeline that's the big expense, but we're going to pay $4 billion for developing the gas fields after the pipeline has been built in this PPT. I think putting gas deductions in an oil tax is the biggest danger that was created in the PPT system. That's where most of the money is going to leave the state. And, you know, I think oil taxes should have oil deductions. I think gas taxes should have gas deductions. You know, when the governor came in and said at Centennial Hall, his staff came in and said, you know, his gas contract is revenue neutral. But then Econ One came in and said, no, the gas contract will raise about $5 to $10 billion less in revenue than current law. We then heard what they meant by revenue neutral was all of the extra money we're making in oil makes up for the money we're going to lose by changing the law in gas. That's what they meant by revenue neutral. So I see that as a huge problem with PPT. The money comes in one end and leaves the other end. And, you know, if we do nothing this session, it should be take the gas deductions, take Exxon's deductions for developing Point Thompson, something they've been legally obligated to do for 20 years with no subsidy, and now we're offering them about $1 billion of subsidies under PPT. Take those off the table. The more deductions that you don't believe in that you take out of PPT, the better the profits tax becomes. So I'm not going to sit here and say you can't tax somebody's profits. Historically, we've done it. But limit the deductions so that people aren't deducting things you don't believe in. A portion of Conoco's building in Houston. I don't know. I've heard conflicting things on whether they're going to be able to apportion parts of things like their buildings outside of Alaska from their Alaska taxes. Conoco's perfectly willing to run that building without a deduction in Alaska, and we're going to maybe give them a deduction. I don't know. I've heard conflicting things on whether that might be deductible the way PPT is written. But
I don't mean to.
Representative Holm.
Okay, I'll come back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Guerra, I just want to thank you for bringing this up because I think it just adds to the dialogue in some areas that we haven't discussed here before. One of my problems is some of the dialogue that you're using continually, and I'm not sure I understand the word fair. Fair to me has an emotional connotation rather than a factual connotation, so I really don't quite, I can't get my hands and my arms and my body and my intellect around the word fair. So without using the word fair, could you give me your analysis of, let me preface this question with one thing. I believe the biggest problem we have in the state of Alaska today is the fact that we're having a reduction in the amount of barrels of oil going in the pipeline. Your proposal, I'd like to know what the purpose of your proposal is of a profit tax, if it is not to assist in more production so that we have more barrels of oil going down the pipeline. And I'd like you to discuss that a little bit, and then I'd like you to tell me if that's not the main reason that we're doing the although the ELF is broken now, we know the ELF is broken, is that not the major reason for the PPT today?
Well, let's go to the first question, which is how you define fair. I purposely took out a slide from this PowerPoint, which was the quote from the Constitution. That's how we're supposed to define fair. I mean, we all know that, so I didn't want to say this is what the Constitution says. We've all talked about it. The Constitution says the people of the state of Alaska are entitled to the maximum benefit possible from their resources. You know, it says either conservation or development of our resources is what the Constitution says. That's what fair is, the maximum benefit we can get. Well, what does the maximum benefit mean? It means the maximum revenue, but the maximum long-term revenue. So to take $30 billion in state revenue this year and dry up every oil field on the North Slope so there's no money next year would be silly. But what's the thing that gives us the maximum long-term revenue? Well, the thing that gives us the maximum long-term revenue is some combination of a high enough tax that we're getting a fair enough share, but a low enough tax that spurs future development. So, you know, I've heard things during the PPT debate that some people have said, which is, you know, the goal is to spur new investment. Well, it is and it isn't. The goal is to, if you can give away $10 million in tax revenue to get $11 million in future development, that's good. But if you're giving away $10 million in tax revenue to spur development that's going to be worth $3 million to you in the future, that's bad. That costs you $7 million, right? And so these flat statements you hear every once in a while is we just have to spur new investment. We do. New investment that will lead to more revenue than we're giving away. And that's the part that gets left out. But what is fair to me is something that leads to the maximum revenue possible. It's easier for the existing fields. We know what their sunk costs are, and they've been sunk, and they've been repaid, and we know what the profit margins are on the existing fields. I would tell you, leaving companies from $30 and above with 20, 30, 40, 40% profit margins is more than fair to them and would result in another $2 billion of revenue to us that would be fair to our schools, fair to deal with the problem of 40% of our kids not graduating high school, and it is not fair not to do that thing right now. It's hard to decide what the tax rate should be on new development. And that's why, I mean, you know, you've seen that's what they do in the United Kingdom. Existing development, a 75% tax. New development, a much lower tax. Whatever our definition of fair is, we have to be able to look at ourselves and say, have we maximized long-term revenue by doing this? Or will we come up with deductions that are going to cost us more than they're going to get us in the long term? And, you know, that's fair, and there's no science to it at all. But we do know what kind of money is being generated on North Slope, and for us to not look at that, I think, is a big problem. You asked whether the main goal of the bill was what? Was it to encourage new investment? Was it to make sure we get a fair share? And it's both. I think you encourage new investment not just by giving money to industry. That's what we've done for the last 10 years. We've given them four times as much in profit over the last 4 years by leaving this outdated tax system in place, and they haven't added a dollar of new investment. Well, I mean, that's probably an exaggeration, not a dollar, but it's averaged about $1 billion a year in investment. So keeping the tax rate low enough, that didn't work. That's an experiment that's failed. We know what happens. I think you should come up with investments that cause companies to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. And so we've come up with severance tax relief. If you need a tax break to make a new field economic or an existing field economic to continue, come to us, show us, and we'll give it to you. If you need the tax break, we'll give it to you. If you don't need it, you're not getting it. I think it's SB 183, the tax credit we extend in this bill. I can go either way on that one, but there was an attempt in there to make that tailored to producing new investment as opposed to giving away money that the companies were going to spend anyway. And the theory there was if you build far enough away from an existing oil field, 3 miles or more, we give you a tax credit for new exploration. Should we give you a tax credit for continuing operations that you probably have an incentive to continue anyway? well, that's more questionable. And so I think you need to, what we've said is let's tailor the tax break to spur new things, but let's not pay for things that the companies were going to do anyway. And somebody once said to me from industry that one way, oddly enough, that you spur new investment by changing your oil tax system is the companies know it's coming. And one of the things perhaps deterring new investment in the state is they know the system is so broken, they want to see what the new thing is going to be in place for the next 15 years. Oddly enough, I think that's going to have an impact on investment. Once the companies know that this outdated tax scheme has finally reached the end of its shelf life and they know what's going to be in its place, I think they invest much more comfortably than they do this year when we're deciding to impose something that they don't know what it's going to look like. So it's to produce more oil, but it's to produce enough money for the things that we and the people of the state believe in, too, and to stop the bleeding.
Could I follow up, please? No, you did not answer my question. So let me see if I can rephrase that. How do you expect that there is one more barrel of oil going to be delivered down that line as it's reducing at 6% per year? You know, 50,000 barrels a year, which is 6% of 850,000 barrels, 50,000 barels a day is $3.5 million a day we're losing in lost production today, at today's cost. How do we, that's the bleeding. We get three things. We get a severance tax, we get a royalty tax, and we also get an income tax, a state income tax from these companies. You're only talking about one of the taxes. That's all you've been talking about here this whole time is one of the taxes. If we increase the production in Prudhoe Bay, we still get more royalties. We still get more. If they make more money, we get more corporate income taxes. So how does your setup here affect reinvestment into Alaska? Because I believe, and I think most of us sit here, believe that if we don't stop the bleeding in Prudhoe Bay, that pipeline in a very short number of years is not effective anymore in terms of providing income for the people of Alaska.
So how do we stop the decline in production?
Yes, sir.
There's an unspoken truth around here that nobody likes to talk about, and I don't know if it's possible to stop the decline. We've had one of the biggest fields ever in Prudhoe Bay, and it's declining. I don't think you can make Prudhoe Bay produce 2 million barrels of oil a day. Maybe you can. But what you're trying to do is produce as much investment as you can to result in long-term revenue benefits. And I don't think anybody has ever come to this legislature and said, with PPT, we're going to have more oil next year than we did last year. I mean, I think what you're trying to do is stem the decline and stabilize it. I'm not the one to tell you whether or not it's really feasible for us to produce 2 million barrels of oil a day again. But what are we doing to try and stem the loss and encourage new investment? Three things. Facilities access, so we don't keep locking the independent producers off the North Slope. The thing that Exxon and BP and Conoco don't like, that they don't want us to talk about. Tax relief when they show us they need it. So we have this inviting investment atmosphere so we can tell companies, if you need a tax break, our doors are open. Come show us and we'll give it to you. I think that's a good thing. An investment exploration credit of up to 40%, depending on how far the new development is. You know, that was the greatest thing since sliced bread when it passed here 3 years ago, and now people are saying that we need something better. Maybe we do need something better. So we give that exploration credit. So investment credits when you need them, access to the smaller producers that are the future of the state. Karen McGee had to fight with Conoco just to get access across Kapar to develop a field recently. They had to threaten litigation. The oil companies in the state at times deter development. They stop development. I mean, let's just recognize that. So do things to make sure we have this atmosphere where companies aren't stopping other companies from developing our resource. So a mix of credits, and I don't. If you come up with a wiser credit than we've proposed in this bill, you know, I applaud you. I mean, just make sure you can answer the question, which is, are you giving money away to companies that they for actions that they were going to engage in anyway? So incentives, fair incentives, and fair access to future North Slope producers. And I think that last point is a huge one. It's something we've never done. And there are those who believe that that's been the biggest failing of this state in a long, long, long time.
Mr. Chairman, I've got to follow up in just one more second. Okay. I'd just like to make a statement because there have been a number of political statements that have been made with regards to this in a number of areas. I would just like to say to you, sir, that capitalism has raised more people's economics in this world than any other form of that's ever been devised by man. And capitalism means that people take money and they invest their own money into facilities that provide jobs, that provide benefits for government, that provide benefits in schooling, et cetera, et cetera. Oil companies provide 80 to 90% of all the money that comes into this building. And we spend it, we dole it out, and we do those things here in the Finance Committee. We want to extract every dollar that's possible. That's maximum benefit. But the other benefits that we get are jobs. There's a lot of other benefits. When you talk about fair, there's a lot of other benefits that we're getting from here that have nothing to do with dollars. We get more oil barrels that come down the line. We get more barrels of oil that come down the line. We get more money in the permanent fund for generations to come. So it's inherent upon us not to kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs. And just because there's money that's coming out of here now, what happened when it was $9 a barrel? We forget. We forget that 18 months ago we had a $400 million deficit here, and only because we have $70 oil are we in such a positive position today. So we cannot, I mean, if I were a company, I would certainly not make my investments based upon a 24-month price increase in the price of tomato plants. I couldn't do that. I don't suspect the oil companies can do the same thing with their investments into Prudhoe Bay. I think it's the right question to ask. Why aren't they putting more than $1 billion a year at the prices we have today? Do we know that they aren't planning? It's not in their portfolios to do so? We don't know. We're not in the boardrooms. But I can guarantee you, sir, that if you raise the taxes high enough, you will stem what you do is you change the environment in Alaska based upon all the other places in the world. We are a small portion of big companies' portfolios. We may be a profitable portion, but we may not be the place where you're going to put more capital. So I think there's the risk that we have, saying that we need to tax them at the very highest rate that we possibly could. And thank you for being here.
I appreciate it. I didn't say to tax them at the highest rate we possibly could, and I think these profit margins we leave them are quite healthy. But certainly that's for the committee to discuss, and I agree with you that capitalism is something that works. So you want to make sure you don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg, but you also don't want the goose to keep taking all your, gold, you know. So you've got to draw a balance.
Thank you, Representative Holm. Representative Jewell.
There's been a couple of references this morning, and apparently when this discussion first started, having to do with issues around access to facilities. And Representative Holmes has I'm trying to recall whether or not we've really had much of a discussion around that area, and I don't know that we have, but I certainly have seen body language that says that maybe it's not an access, another body language that says, or it is an issue, and others that said it's not an issue. And I'm just wondering whether or not that would be a discussion worth having to see whether or not that is stemming exploration in the state. And if it's going to keep coming up, because I have heard it. And I'm not sure I know the right questions to ask, but I think that for those that are wanting access and those that need to give access are at the table. Maybe those are questions that this committee can pinpoint to see whether or not that's an issue that's in front of us, because ultimately we should know that. It's going to affect the other things that we need to look at down the line.
I think
not have a comment here.
Representative Jules, right? I think you should hold hearings on facilities access. I mean, let's find out whether it's the one thing we can do to do more for North Slope development than anything, or let's find out whether it doesn't make sense. And so you need other people here to tell you that.
Yeah, I agree. And I've heard that comment as well, Representative Jewell. And I think that may be why you're seeing some of these smaller companies team up with the larger companies like Anarco with ConocoPhillips at Alpine, and I think Pioneer is also teamed up with ConocoPhillips to some extent, so that way they can have access to the facilities. However, they shouldn't necessarily have to team up with a major to get access. But I think that's discussion for another day. Although I think the chairman here does want to have industry here tomorrow, and I think that would be a good question to ask them also. Representative Kelly?
Just a comment. I appreciate the presentation. And there's quite a struggle going on around the building, recognition of a couple things. One is we've got about 2 weeks. We've had two blowouts on this thing so far where we haven't been able to get it done. Got a couple of weeks left before the end of this second special session. And there's a lot of talk in the hallways about gross versus net, and it looks like what you've tried to do here is solve some of the problems that would be unique to a gross. But a couple of questions. Yesterday, Dr. Van Meer said that if Governor Knowles had accepted his recommendation on a gross, we'd have saved about $6 to $8 billion that we've lost. So it looks like it's hard for any governor to get anything done around here on taxes. But for whatever reason that Governor Knowles did not accept his recommendation, you were here for that conversation yesterday. If he had accepted that and we'd have saved the $6 to $8 billion, would we be here today, or would that model, that gross model, have worked? Have you looked at that, or would that have also needed tuning?
So how do we deal with the Murkowski-Knowles thing without getting everybody's neck hairs up? In fairness to Governor Knowles and Governor Murkowski, I can't answer this without angering people, probably. This has not been a legislature that's been real interested in tax reform. Senator Torgerson came up with an oil tax reform, I think, with the help of Pedro Van Meer's.
My question is narrow. My question is narrower than that. I didn't mean to trigger that. It was just that was in the testimony yesterday. Yeah. If that gross, which had some similarities right to what you're proposing, had been put in place, my question is narrow. Would it need adjusting today? I don't know the answer. Would it need, because I just got the material, would it need adjusting here today, or would we be just talking about a gas line?
I just got a proposal today, too. I spoke to him about it in the hallway yesterday. It's pretty darn similar to what we're proposing. I don't think we'd be here today. I mean, I don't think, you know, Pedro Van Meer said he presented it to this governor and the last governor. There hasn't been an appetite of enough of us to talk about oil taxes until this year. But I don't think we'd be here today if we did anything like that, because what we've all been proposing and what everybody here is proposing now is something with a progressivity feature. And that's what Daniel Johnston says works. That's the thing that keeps you from having to change your oil tax systems over time. It's something that on the books now changes. And so I think it's the progressivity feature to any of these things that will make the tax law stable into the future. And if we adopted it last year, year before, or 10 years ago, I think we'd be in great shape.
Just one follow-on, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. You mentioned separating gas and oil, and that certainly to a lot of us at points along the trail here has appeared to be very attractive, because the two collide when you mix two very dissimilar commodities, even though they're both hydrocarbon-based, you run into problems. And it seems that what you were mentioning is, you know, we could get to where we need to be to stop the bleeding through a gross or a net. But if we had a net, what I think I heard you say was that separating gas from oil would be almost a necessary measure. And the second thing was defining disallowed expenses so that the system gaming that those who are looking at the gross would like to do. Have you
have you put together, we saw a list yesterday of the disallowed costs. Have you put together a list of the ones that if they were stuck in would satisfy the, you know, where you're coming from on the gross versus net?
Sure. That's a fair question. Well, gas would be number one, right? That's the biggest one you could put on the list to make PPT work better than anything you can do. Some of them, Representative Hawker was right, other people are right. Some of them are, well, I think probably legal, but are going to require court challenges. So what you do when you put those in, when you say Conoco can't deduct any of the costs of its Houston building from its Alaska taxes, you have to have a severability clause that says if this part is declared unconstitutional, only this part is stricken from the law and the rest of the law remains on the books, right? I mean, that's how you solve those constitutional problems. I think I have been told that if you limit the deductions to use terms like direct Alaska costs, direct costs related to Alaska production, using the word direct or even stronger, you get somewhere. And I think the word direct has been in some versions of the PPT in the past. But I think if that's what you're going to do, you get somebody smarter than me to come up with the list, and I think there are people, you know, if they're willing to help in the Department of Revenue, who could help with that. But you know, frankly, what we have is this political process where people who work for people are just proposing the ideas that their superiors want them to propose, and so we haven't had that help, I don't think, from the Department of Revenue.
One last
question.
The final thing I wanted to thank you, that's helpful. In the area of disallowed costs, one of the things that I've heard in the debate all around that's going on relative to gross versus net is to use the example of the rebuild of Prudhoe as an allowable cost when we're trying to incent investment in the future. Any comments on that, or how that might, if we're trying to use a net system, at least a portion of the system being net, so that we are ready at the gate to do heavy oil and allow for the differences between 25 degree crude and 14 degree crude, what would you do, what changes would you make in addition to this list you talk about that would take care of the concern that I've heard expressed by the gross, some of the folks on the gross side, about that rebuild situation?
Two things. First of all, let me just make clear, I mean, I think you solve all of these problems by going to the gross, so that's my preference. But if you're going to try and make a profits tax work, how do you allow, what portion of the rebuild cost would you allow as opposed to cost for new exploration? I think it's hard to, but very possible, to define what expenses to allow at Prudhoe Bay that were going to be expended anyway, and what expenses lead to the expansion and extension of the life at Prudhoe Bay. And it's those latter ones that you would want to incent, except that there is some incentive at an existing oil field for the company to do that anyway. It's not like it wants that golden egg to disappear too. So are you providing an incentive for something they were going to pay for on their own? Are you subsidizing something that they were going to pay for? And that's the question that has to be asked on each one of these levels. And that's almost the beauty of the royalty relief and then the new proposal we had, which is severance tax relief. What you can do is what we suggest is for any of these additional expenses, maybe only allow them to be deducted this way, have them come to the state and say, you know, we want to extend the life of Prudhoe Bay. The current tax system is keeping us from doing that. We need an additional tax break from you to do it. And if they show that they really do need that, we give it to them. See, the problem right now is we're picking numbers from thin air and saying the number we just picked is going to work for a brand new development we've never seen before. Or the number we just picked is going to work for something on Prudhoe Bay 5 years from now. I don't know that. And so that's the advantage of having tax relief that says, show us you need it and you get it, as opposed to, here it is, even though if we don't know you need it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Representative LeDoux?
Well, I lean towards a gross tax because it seems a lot simpler and doesn't allow for the gaming that we've been talking about. But on the other hand, I kind of struggle with the idea, because it seems like most of this country's system of taxation is based upon profits. I mean, I own a business myself, and I know that my gross is a heck of a lot different than my net is. So do you have any comments on that?
I do, Representative Ledoux. I think it's fine to tax profits in a lot of areas. And I could be wrong, if somebody else has to testify to this. I think on oil, most places in the United States should actually do something on the gross, but around the world, I think the general way to do it is on profits. I could be wrong about that. But in other areas, people do things on profits. That's your bigger point. But when they do it on profits, they don't do it in a way that the governor has proposed in this PPT. I would be surprised to find more than a couple places in the world that have a profit system on oil that allow a company to deduct their gas costs. Right? So if you're going to tax profits, do it wisely. And weigh the benefits and the burdens. So you can tax profits, but I think you have to be very careful about what you let people deduct. And I was shocked, frankly, in February when all of a sudden this bill that was supposed to be an oil tax bill had a whole section on gas. I know people on both sides of the aisle were quite surprised by that. And at first we were told not to worry about it because, don't worry about it. We'll come up with a gas tax rate in the contract, and that's going to govern things. Well, as it turns out, the reason that was in this bill was to allow $4 billion in future deductions for gas to come out of oil, so that we possibly lose the upside we've created for oil by a downside on gas. And, I got to say, I'm a little bit angry at some of the stuff I heard at Centennial Hall about when they said revenue neutral. I thought they meant revenue neutral just on the gas tax. It turned out they meant revenue neutral by what we get in oil we give away in gas. That was never explained at Centennial Hall. Those are the kinds of things that I would take out of any bill on profits, because you're right. People do normally tax profits, and I think people are very careful about deductions.
Representative Meyer, you had a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up to Representative Ledoux's comments, and I've heard the same comments, and I think Representative Garib, you've mentioned this too, is a concern to the net profits system is the possibility of the gaming. You know, that the industry would come and talk Department of Revenue, I guess, into some deductions that we may or may not think are appropriate. But yet, aren't you proposing the same thing here with the gross by saying that if they need tax relief, that they can come to the Department of Revenue and ask for relief? I mean, don't you still have that same potential of gaming?
I don't think so, Representative Meyer. The gaming in a profits tax is this. We don't have access to the company's books. They tell us what their profits are. If we don't challenge them and sue them, we don't ever see what their profits really were, and we take their word for it. We have no way of guessing their Alaska profits accurately because they do a federal tax return that doesn't list their Alaska revenue and profits. They do a worldwide apportionment one in Alaska that doesn't list their Alaska profits and revenue. So we have no access to know what their Alaska profits were other than their reports on their tax return. I think there's a lot of room for gaming in that system. Does our severance tax proposal allow for gaming? No. If we said you get severance tax if you just tell us you need it. Just submit a couple pieces of paper and tell us you need it. But that's not what we're saying. The severance tax relief that we're going to allow, the production tax relief that we're going to allow, I'm sorry for saying severance tax. The current law, sometimes people call it the severance tax, sometimes people call it the production tax. It's the same thing. It isn't gamed because they have to come in with what's called clear evidence and establish with that clear evidence that they need the tax break. That's a pretty darn accurate system. Can they lie? Yeah. Can anybody lie? Sure. In any aspect of any part of state government, can somebody screw up the system by lying? Yeah, but you try to create the protections to minimize that opportunity. Instead of just saying, let's have a production tax relief system that says the companies tell us they need it, we say they not only have to tell us, but they have to prove it. And I think that's what's deterred a lot of severance tax or royalty relief applications in the past. You know, at at now $30, $40, $50, $60 a barrel, companies know they can't pass the red face test on saying we need severance tax relief on Prudhoe Bay.
And I don't want to split hairs with you, but I think you could do the same thing on the net profits tax. You could say, you know, if you want to count this as a deduction, prove that it really is a deduction and prove that it really costs that amount. So I think the gaming is possible either system, if industry wants to do that, or if that truly would or does happen. And I guess that's why we have auditors, to make sure that doesn't happen. If I may, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of things I like about your presentation. In particular, I like.
Could you say that again?
Well, in particular, I like the incentives for heavy oil, and as we talked about yesterday with Dr. Van Meers, heavy oil is known. I mean, there's huge accumulations of heavy oil up there with that UGNU and WestSAC, probably. Estimated 25 billion barrels of oil in place just between those two fields. Now, how much is recoverable is probably maybe 20-25%, depending on how much you want to spend and the technology available. So we know exploration. We heard yesterday that one out of every 10 wells may hit something that's actually economical. So exploration is very risky, very costly, millions of dollars. But the heavy oil is there and it's known, and we just need to figure out a way to get it economically. Have you thought of, and I see here that you're saying anything less than 20 API, which would include UGNU and WestSAC and maybe some of the other fields. Do you have incentives in place to go after the heavy oil?
Yeah, I proposed two alternative ones, right? I mean, let's just leave the wording of the bill to the side. My goal is to get a discussion going here. I think Senator Wagner would say, although I'll leave it for him, but he and I have had a discussion, I think what you do for heavy oil is exactly what I've been talking about before with royalty relief, but also allow it for the production tax too. Show us you need it, and we'll give it to you. That's the most flexible system you could possibly have. And because the heavy oil technology, as Dr. Van Meers says, is going to change over time. So what you need today isn't going to be what you need 10 years from now. Show us you need it, and we give you the tax relief, and we'll make that field a go if we can. So I think that's the best solution you could do for heavy oil. I propose in this bill to just leave the current law there for heavy oil. What that will do is, on very large heavy oil fields, there will be a tax. On small, on most heavy oil fields, there won't be a production tax. I don't think that's the best way to go. I sort of left that blank because I wanted people to talk about it. But I'm sympathetic, I think, to the whole idea that with heavy oil, you come up with some tax, maybe half of this tax level, some tax, and say, if you need a break, show us, and we'll give it to you. And I think the case can be made for a field that, for much of the heavy oil that's out there, that folks might need a tax break. But maybe that's not going to be the case 10 years from now.
Okay, and then how do you prevent the gaming? I mean, if they go to you and say, we want a tax break on heavy oil, what proof would they have to show you?
Well, they'd have to produce economics.
They'd have to produce geological and economic evidence. See, that's the difference between PPT, where you have auditors, but you're not conducting a hearing on their tax return. You accept their tax return, and if there's something really, really, really suspicious that jumps out at you, then you sue them. But generally, you accept the tax return. That's the problem with just having auditors. Unless you actually have a hearing, you don't get very much evidence. What we do in the royalty relief law that we have on the books now and the severance or the production tax relief law we'd like to adopt is say there will be a hearing. You'll present witnesses. We'll present witnesses. Our officials will listen. Our best officials will listen to all the evidence out there to see whether the geology of the field, whether the economics of the field require some sort of a tax break. And if that's about all the information you could possibly get, and then you make the decision. Yeah, I mean, there's always gaming because people can lie under oath, and you might not be able to catch them. They could present doctored evidence, and you might not be able to catch them. But at least you have a much better chance of being able to tell the truth when somebody's under oath, when you have witnesses on both sides, than you do when you get a piece of paper from one side, and you have to guess whether or not the data behind it is fake or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Katula.
Well, I just wanted to point out and make sure I'm right. No other state uses net profit sharing, and there are countries that are now turning away from it. I mean, Bolivia is a current example. I'm right by that.
I wouldn't want to do what Bolivia is doing, I don't think. But
No other state uses this system.
I'm not the right person to answer. My understanding is that that states generally have a gross value tax as part of their tax systems, and that worldwide many countries use, some countries that own the oil and own the production facilities, you know, take almost everything, right, over 90% in some places. I'm not the right person to ask about that.
An important point on that issue, on that particular issue, is they pay for all of it, too.
Sure.
If they own the facilities and they own the oil, then they pay all costs except operating costs. And so if you're a corporation doing business in any country, if you're doing business in Alaska and somebody's paying all your costs, you can probably do it a little bit cheaper than somebody who's paying costs. But with that, Representative Ledoux.
If we could just go back to the dialogue between you and Representative Meyer for a second. This entity which is going to be hearing the producer's request for a break, is this going to be a new tribunal? Is this already in...
Representative Ledoux, it's already in place. It's going to be the same group of people who hear current law, royalty relief applications. So we use the same exact system that's in place that says if you need a tax break to make a field economic and you show us with clear evidence that you can to get a reduction in your royalty under that same system, we'll also, if you need it, give you a reduction in your production tax. So it does. It leaves the same exact process that's in place right now.
Follow up? So is there any right of appeal from this? I mean, if the state says you don't have a legitimate claim, does this go someplace to the courts, or where does it go?
I can only bet a box of donuts on this one. I think there's always a right to appeal from an agency decision. I'm confident of that, but I didn't look that up. I'm confident of it, though, and there should be.
Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Just the idea, again, of we got 2 weeks. It's going to take a pretty good effort by this body to do what really needs to be done, and that is get the cash register fixed here. And we've got gross people, we've got net people, and some folks in between still looking to see which way they want to jump.
Mm-hmm.
One of the difficulties that I see with saying that, well, here's the tax, the problem with the gross, and if you come and make a good case 5 years from now that it's killing you, we'll help you. But I'm an investor, and I'm clear back not only 5 years back in that equation, but a couple before that trying to figure out whether to make an investment. I can see some problems with that, so I guess I'm thinking in the area of splitting oil and gas apart completely and increasing the size of that list that you've referred to of costs that won't be allowed in the credit mix. Is that somewhere at the end of the day or the end of 2 weeks here and it's time to push the green one or the red one, that if it ends up on a net basis with some of those increases in the list and maybe trying to get us away from the oil coupled to gas problem, you punch a green button on that? I mean, I'm not asking you. I'm using that just as an indication of would you see that as a way to get there if the crowd that says it should be based on net would offer that and it would prevail?
If we came up with I would prefer not to come up with a net, right, for all the reasons we've discussed. If we got rid of gas deductions, came up with a list of exemptions so that I didn't think the system would be gamed, and then, you know, frankly, also did something we've done with none of the PBTs, which is tax it something close to the world average instead of so much below the world average, I think I'd be there in a second. I've said that in the past. It's not my preferred way of doing things, but limit the opportunities for gaming, get rid of this whole idea that you deduct gas from oil taxes, come up with a tax that has us not taxing less, still less than most places in the world. You know, I think Senator Wagner in my view, Senator Wagner did the best job of anybody during the session of any bill that got passed out of a committee. His bill came the closest to what I think the evidence justified, except it also included some of the exemptions that I don't think should have been in there. And then I have a lot of heartache with also giving any credit for Exxon at Point Thompson when they should be doing for, with no subsidy, what we would give them credits for.
That's a maybe.
I mean, yeah, if there's movement that way, I just have never seen it. I haven't seen it in 4.5 months here. All I've seen is, no, we're not taking gas out of the bill. So, you know, are people really willing to start negotiating on those things? I'm willing to negotiate on it, but it's not my preferred way of doing it.
But we got to get 32 yeses to get something out of here. I'm just asking. Thank you.
Representative Kelly, could I just one more way of getting out of here, which is your request?
Representative Gere.
The reason why I'm pushing this gross bill right now in special session and trying to and get everybody involved in the dialogue is that I think in a matter of an afternoon, you're talking about a way to get something done this session in the waning 20 days. I think if we can come up with the credit system that we want, we come up with the revenue we want at various prices, I think we could craft a bill in the course of 2 afternoons. You know, so like I said, and I keep going back to this, I think the 23.5% tax, PPT tax that we passed in the House was a little low for my desires, but I voted for it. Let's say that's where our consensus is. That's the amount of money at various prices we want. You can come up with a gross tax in 2 days of work, I think, that raises more money than that, but then lets you deduct the credits and gets you to that level. And that's I think one of the advantages of the gross tax here. The public wants it, and it's easy to do and easy to tailor to the goals that you want to reach. And this is the worst scenario, but way better than doing nothing, which is, and if you can't figure out a comprehensive system for the future of Alaska for the next 30 years, let's just tax existing oil and figure out what to do for new exploration next year. That's not the best alternative, but it might get us out of here and result in us stemming this loss of $2 billion of revenue this year and next year.
Well, you're looking in the eyeballs of a guy that's tried as hard as anybody to get the fair share for Alaska. So I mean, we've got our cut out for us. Thank you.
No, I am.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other thing. Les, would you know why there's a significant difference between the fiscal note from 3001, HB 3001, and the fiscal note for HB 3004? Why it is so much significantly less to audit, or maybe Robin Wilson can speak to it. But
I didn't get a chance to take a look at the fiscal notes. The chart they gave you from the Department of Revenue, that I got in time for this hearing, but I haven't seen the fiscal notes yet.
Thank you. Maybe we could ask her.
Robin, would you like to come forward maybe and talk about the fiscal note difference?
You said that's what we're here for.
Yes, thank you again. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson, the tax director of the Department of Revenue. There is the difference, the key difference, I think, between the two bill fiscal notes is the number of auditors would be the main difference, I think. And if we look back at the fiscal note from the original governor's February, I believe we'll see 4 auditors mm-hmm. on there. And as I think I mentioned earlier this morning, as that bill has gone through various various committees and so on, there's been additional complexities. For example, the 4 areas of the state. And so on. And so that has added in the complexities that have required additional auditors. So if you look then at the fiscal note for 3003, I believe we've got 8 on there. For the bill 3004, I believe we've got the equivalent of a half of FTE for an auditor and a half an FTE for an engineer, and that is mainly due to the provision for the heavy oil. So, you know, certainly there would be more auditing that would be done under 3001 than 3004. But again, depending on, for example, how many credits are envisioned, certainly that could vary.
Representative Holton, follow up.
I wanted to point that out because it does make a difference in terms of your workload as to how you're going to be auditing. Is that correct? I mean, what we're looking at here, it takes less people to audit the gross tax. I mean, if I'm reading this wrong, you tell me. Then versus a net tax.
No, you are correct. There would be more expenses to audit, certainly. And again, to the extent that, say, we divide up the state into regions and now have to pin down expenses per region and so on, then it does add to it.
Thank you very much.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you. Through this whole period, one of the biggest things that seems to be out there is this paranoia that we as a legislature have about being gamed with the system. And it's built on a couple of things. Number one, you know, there's a proposal to change how we're doing things, and sometimes we resist change just by nature, so we question. But the other is built on some of the history in Alaska. And the public sees some of that history, whether it's an unsettled claim with Exxon or whether it's more other news of what's going on with other large producers in the country, and a distrust. And I think to get around the issue of whether or not we're going to be gamed is how well we staff our departments, our auditors, and how we're able to get them from being stolen for us by being competitive. And I think that can stop some of the concern of the gaming, regardless of which administration is in. And you know, when I had some questions on auditing, do we have enough? And is there, if that is a paranoia amongst us, if we, for whatever reason, might not have the faith in DOR, is there another system within our government that allows us to do that? And is that? You know, there seems to be this natural tension between DNR and DOR, and do we create some repetition there that allows an administration to be able to take a look at what the auditors are telling them? And so I think I'm not as paranoid as I initially started out being about being gamed. If we do the kinds of things we need to do in how we staff up for this, in terms of the people that we hire and how competitive we and our ability to retain those people, which gets to other issues, and we dealt with that in part. But you know, I think those are really kind of the underlying things. This whole system of whether or not somebody's going to get away with gaming us, it's how we prepare to deal with those audits and the kind of staff that we're able to bring in and how competitive we're going to be able to be.
Representative Kratula?
Well, I have a question that brings up, and I think maybe Robin can answer it, but I'd like to agree with what Representative Jewell just said, but when you start out with just accepting what the companies have agreed to in an operating agreement, that's where I think your problem starts. I mean, you have to accept it. It's just, you know, you don't even go past that. So my question is, do you currently, in current audits, find things that are in the operating agreements that wouldn't be allowed by statute currently? I mean, do you find that now?
Through the chair, Representative Kurtula. Well, currently, now we do not audit upstream costs. Are you referring perhaps?
Well, I'm just thinking, I'd be surprised if you didn't find problems in, you know, the current operating agreements that would allow things that maybe you didn't think should be allowed. And if we go to this system where we have to allow them, that's what I'm wondering about. That's what's causing me trouble. So the question is, I would assume you must find at times things that you don't think are allowable, that, you know, the argument is, well, but it's in the operating agreement. We're living under it right now.
And so I would just refer back, and I can give you the page, but we can certainly flip through here. But in 160C, I believe, but we can certainly look. You know, it says that, first of all, you note that substantial weight shall be given to industry standards, but then it also says that, you know, that the department may allow a producer to claim his expenses, those things on operating agreements, if they're consistent with the principles in the rest of the bill. So I can't really see, I'm having a little difficulty seeing sort of the potentiality that you're talking about. And as Mr. Mintz, you know, noted yesterday, you know, we do have the audit powers, and
Representative Kutuma, follow
up. I just don't think it's a clear answer. I'll follow up with you. I'd like to know what kinds of things you find now in operating, that operating agreements would allow that really shouldn't be allowed. I mean, I'm interested in knowing that. If you do find those kinds of things in your audits and what it says now, what our current experience is now, because I think that might be helpful to know. Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Kutula, right now what we audit are just the transportation costs. Now, perhaps DNR may be able to give you more of an answer for the net operating share leases.
I think,
but for the Department of Revenue, just looking currently at transportation costs, I don't believe the operating agreements would enter into that.
No, it's a good point. Maybe it goes more toward DNR, and I'll certainly ask them. And obviously, we do find things in the transportation costs all the time that we raise in tariff disputes. So we know the answer to that is that there are things that we disagree with. So thanks.
Representative Berkowitz.
I'll pass.
Okay. Representative LeDoux.
All right. Going to these audit costs. There's been talk that we just have to accept the producer's word for things. But generally, when an audit's done, if the auditor disallows something, isn't it then on the person or the entity that's being audited to prove that it's justified? How does it work now? How is it going to work under any of the bills that we've done? I know when I've been, you know, when people I know have been audited by IRS, if IRS says, okay, something's disallowed, then it seems to be their obligation to go into tax court and prove that it's an allowable deduction.
Yes. Chair, Representative LeDoux, you're absolutely correct that the burden of proof is on the taxpayer. And I think Mr. Mintz perhaps explained this a little bit yesterday, and I'm not sure if he's on the line today, but this bill does not change the burden of proof requirements. And I also noted yesterday that our audit powers under the administration sections, which is 4305, are very broad, and that we can go in and inspect the records of anyone that would have whose books pertain to or would help us figure out the tax liability of the tax return in front of us. What that means is if the books are in the hands of a third party, we can go to that third party and say, we have the authority to look at your books and records. So it isn't just necessarily that taxpayer. So if we're talking about a tax return you know, one of the joint interest owners, and we need to go to look at the operator's books, we can do that. So there's not that problem there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
And I don't know how frequently the department actually engages in audits, and that's the issue. When you get the piece of paper that says, here's our tax return, if everyone is audited in detail, that's one thing. But if you're not auditing most of them and because you don't have the manpower or because you're just willing to accept something on face value, then you don't know that the cost that was reported maybe from Texas up to Alaska, then reported to a third person and to a fourth person and a fifth person, and then ended up on the piece of paper was accurate. So if you're checking the paper trail for each of those expenses, that's one thing, and I think you should be pretty comfortable. If you're not checking the paper trail for each of those expenses, at some point you're taking something on faith that I'm uncomfortable taking on faith. And I don't know how frequently and how detailed the audits actually are, or maybe under like the corporate income tax we have right now, what percentage of them are audited and what percentage aren't.
But if the state wished to follow the paper trail, even under a profits tax, it would be able to do so. It wouldn't simply have to take the word of the taxpayer.
Ms. Wilson.
To that, yes, you're absolutely right. We have the authority to go in and look at all of the books and records. In terms of, you know, how, if I could maybe just address a little, you know, how do we look at audits? How do we do them? You know, when we look at any audit, and it's income tax, production tax, or really any of the excise taxes that we audit, there is a judgment call. You know, we are not going to spend, we are going to spend state resources, audit resources, you know, where they are effective. And so we look at, you know, the size of the taxpayer. How much of the tax base are we talking about? We look at how big are the particular expenditures. Where is the risk? Okay, we are not going to go audit every single $10 expenditure. It would not be a prudent use of state resources. So yes, there is a judgment call in there, but that's kind of some of the factors that we take into consideration. And you know, big taxpayers are audited
pretty regularly,
every year, year in, year out. Again, looking at sort of broad, I'm talking about all of our taxes now. If it's a taxpayer that pays this much tax to the state, again, we have taxpayers that maybe write a $100 check to the state. We have to make a judgment about whether that's a good use of state resources. Again, looking at what is the risk, and what is the potential loss to the state? So those are the kinds of things that we look at.
Representative Kelly.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Robin, on this whole gross versus net thing, and of course the chant, the one with the belt, is the bill in front of us, and that's a net bill. That's the one we're starting with anyway in this effort. One of the criticisms has been the difficulty with combining gas and oil instead of completely separating this. What are the problems associated with completely separating this production tax bill from anything to do with gas and saying that, forget Cook Inlet and the Nenana Basin for just a minute. What's the matter with doing that? What's the problem it creates for you?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Kelly. The problem comes in potential where assets, particularly where assets are used to bring up both gas and oil, allocating those assets. So at any particular well may
just
bring
up
both.
Just come up with a formula.
You know, if there's a statutory allocation, that's not too hard. But is that accurate as time goes on and looking at different fields? May or may not be accurate. So. That would be my main issue is those sorts of allocation problems. And just, you know, it really would create a burden, both, you know, record keeping and auditing as to those allocations.
How do you do that now?
Well, under the current production tax system, we just audit the transportation, so it's not really issue in terms of, again, I'm not familiar with the net profit share leases that DNR audits, but certainly DNR could perhaps address that question if you'd like.
See, seems to me that it may be worth the risk to do that, because I can see a lot of risk with combining the two. That's come up time and time and time again. One way to do that, of course, is to give you the power to make the final determination on the allocation between the two. But I appreciate what you just said. But I do believe that is one of the hits that the net approach has been taking since we first came to table, is the difficulty that occurs with trying to do a bill that covers both oil and gas. I understand the reason for it, because oil, gas, and BS&W all come out of the same hole, so there's a problem there. But thank you.
Representative Berkowitz.
You currently do audits, and my question has to do with how often when you audit do you find discrepancies, and roughly what's the monetary value of those discrepancies under the current system?
Berkowitz, I would say it's pretty common. And when we say discrepancies, it may be a simple mathematical error. It may be a different interpretation of law. So there's a number of sort of reasons why there might be differences and adjustments there too. In terms of dollar amount, I'm not prepared to give you this at this time. I can certainly come back and perhaps with better information for you. But I don't have that information today.
I'm just looking for the incidence of conflicts here. So of these, how many audits do you do a year? And of the type that break down as being mathematical error, roughly what percentage are those? And of the ones where there's difference in interpretation, what are they and how often do they occur?
To the Chair, Representative Berkowitz, if I could, I would like to defer answering that question. I'd like to go back and get the information for you rather than try to give you perhaps inaccurate numbers off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think we'll be here for a while. So,
any other members have questions? I have probably two. Back on your slideshow on page 26.
26.
Yeah. Was there any explanation, and I'm not disputing the numbers, I've seen where the numbers came from, but I'm looking at the Alaska profits of ConocoPhillips versus BP, and was there anything in their annual report that indicated why, because I believe at the current time, Conoco processes more oil than BP does. Why BP's profits were higher in Alaska than Conoco's were?
Mr. Chair, my guess would be, and it's only a guess, that BP, I think maybe it's because of their portfolio in Alaska and the percentage share that they have at Prudhoe Bay, which I would guess is maybe the most or one of the most profitable fields in the state. Maybe Conoco is operating a larger portfolio of smaller fields than BP is, but I don't know that.
Earlier you were talking about royalty relief and severance tax relief. And forgive me because I haven't looked at any of those issues, and it's been a number of years since we've had any ask. Royalty relief, does that actually come from the royalty share of oil?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So then that would have if we had them coming in asking for royalty relief, then actually that would affect the fund and other revenue sources.
Mm-hmm. It would, and that would be one of the advantages of allowing people to do production tax relief instead. That way it wouldn't come out of the permanent.
Your bill proposes to use severance tax relief versus royalty relief?
It would give the state the option, or give the taxpayer the option. I think you could. I think the reason we propose production tax relief in this bill is it may be, and I'm sure it is, I'm sure of this, any bill that any of us pass is going to have imperfections in it. Any production tax that any of us come up with is going to be imperfect. And so by allowing for production tax relief, you say if there's an imperfection in our guess on what kind of tax rate you needed for your field, we can correct the imperfection if you come to us and show that you need us to.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Jewell.
Sorry, I've been in and out of the room, and I don't know whether or not this question has been asked. But yesterday, in comparing the net versus the gross, one of the things that there was two big issues between the two that Dr. Van Meers pointed to. One of them you've addressed with regards to heavy oil. Has there been any discussion on the length of the shelf life on the gross v. net? And how do you see this, and where does that fall? Is that a short shelf life, or is this constructed in such, and are there advantages to a short shelf life?
Yeah, the I think we had consultants during the PPT testimony who explained the reason we're here right now, and the reason why the shelf life of this law probably expired 5 years ago, the law we have now, maybe longer, maybe shorter, is that it has no progressivity feature. It's inflexible. It doesn't adjust as the world adjusts. And the testimony was, with a progressivity feature, if it's done correctly, the progressivity feature will change as the world changes. It'll change your law every day the world changes, the world price of oil changes. And so I think with the progressivity feature, you end up with a more stable system. I don't know how many years it would last. I think anything that we come up with, we're going to find flaws with, and hopefully if they're not major flaws, we leave the system as stable as possible. Though the truth is, even under the ELF system, companies came in and had it changed a number of times, and I think maybe even the state had something change in its favor once. You have minor changes, and I think you probably should have minor changes to when you figure out you did something wrong. But the general structure, I think once you have a progressivity feature and you come up with a system you believe in, my God, you saw how much effort it took to get this thing going this year. It's not going to happen for a long time, I think. But your guess is as good as mine. The progressivity feature is a huge part of it.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Guerra, for the presentation on your bill.
Thank you.
Next meeting is tomorrow, 10 a.m. We will take up all three bills again, HB 3001, HB 3003, and HB 3004. We will first hear HB 3003, and then we will, I believe that we have scheduled I think there's one department that's coming in, and we're going to have some testimony from the oil industry people on all three options. And we will see where we proceed from there. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, I'll bring the committee to a close. And thanks for being here, and see you in the morning at 10 o'clock.
Good.
Yep, we're adjourned. You can have him call now. Harris came in and turned off his phone. He said, I figured you had your phone back here.